thanking the organizers of the colloquium for the opportunity to tell you a little bit about one of the projects I'm working on lately. This project actually dates back quite a ways. In fact, at the tail end of this colloquium, I'll bring up an issue which I had raised in the my kind of postdoc interview talk when I came here in 2002 or 2003. At the time, it was a conjecture about the nature of quantum classical correspondence based on some numerical evidence in model systems. And now, as you'll see from the talk, there's quite a developed kind of underlying theory to suggest that those numerical results were in fact typical and believable as a generic phenomenon. And I just wanted to say also, it's quite nice to be back at PI. I'm here currently on a sabbatical visit, and it's been nice to be kind of living the postdoc life again of waking up every morning and only having to think about research. It's very refreshing, and really happy to see that even though perimeter has grown quite a bit, that you still maintain here essentially optimal conditions for research. So thanks for that opportunity as well. So what I'm going to talk about today, kind of the seeds of this idea are quite old, but most of the technical meat that will be added has been done jointly with Cosmin Ududek, who's a PhD student who'll be graduating this summer, and he's somewhere around here. And then also a Nathan Weeb, a postdoc of mine and Andrew Childs at IQC, who brought a different set of expertise to this problem. So a very old question is, okay, so let me just warn you in advance. I have this really bad habit of writing full sentences on my slides. So there's going to be some tension between, do you listen to me, or do you read the sentences? And I don't know what the resolution is, but hopefully we'll find some happy equilibrium at some point through the talk. So a very old problem is understanding how the properties of statistical mechanics emerge from the underlying reversible theory. I mean, this problem existed back before quantum mechanics, when we just had classical mechanics and classical statistical mechanics, and it was a difficult problem then. And really, there was only a satisfactory resolution, I think, by the late 20th century of the classical picture. And here we'll be looking at this problem in the quantum setting and understanding its general consequences. Some of the kinds of things people worry about are understanding how to justify the fundamental statistical postulate, which is that for a system in microcanonical equilibrium, all microstates are equally probable. Understanding how the irreversibility of the second law emerges from the underlying reversible theory. And understanding how one gets a Gibbs state, namely the canonical thermal state, for a system coupled to a bath. So let me just start with a very crude idea of equilibration, which is that the values of some physically accessible observables approach and remain close to some equilibrium values. And these equilibrium values are distinguished because they should only depend on the energy of the system and and should not depend on the details of the initial state. So this is kind of like a broad stroke of the kind of thing we want to achieve. And I want to emphasize that there are both conceptual and practical aspects to this problem. So we want to understand something about the kinds of conditions that emerge, and that are required rather, and at what timescales actual physical systems will equilibrate. So condensed matter systems and many-body physics and so on. So let's just kind of remind ourselves of how the classical setting works. Boltzmann had this approach, which was that you want to show that for some phase-based trajectory, it spends equal times in areas of equal measure. And so clearly this idea is going to require, when you're talking about a physical macroscopic measurement, the idea is that happens over some physical time scale. And within that time scale, the microscopic states have explored some region of phase space that's proportional to the measure of that region. And then the ergodic hypothesis allows substituting the time averages for phase space averages. And then on the other hand, there's the approach of Gibbs, which really looked for a stronger condition than ergodicity, namely a condition of mixing. And the idea of mixing is that you start out with, here, so P is your phase space, and you start out with some state that's highly localized in the phase space, and then you evolve in time, and if the system is mixing, then what you find is that the state becomes spread out over essentially the accessible space. Now, there are constraints on what happens here, which I'll address later in the talk. But even though I think there's still some debate between Boltzmann and Gibbs's points of view, and I'm sure there are entire PhD theses written on this topic just in the classical setting, the impression I have is, at least from the people who work in the theory of classical chaos, is that essentially the Gibbs picture is the right one, but it's still not a not a full explanation because it doesn't really account for individual measurements on individual systems. I mean, here this red blob is describing the kind of virtual statistical ensemble of possible initial conditions that are consistent with our knowledge, our initial knowledge. And the idea is that that kind of lack of information, which is initially localized for some non-equilibrium state, can spread out over the physically accessible phase space. Okay, so three little asterisks like this mean that there's something I'm supposed to mention, which I'm actually forgetting, so unfortunately, I guess it wasn't that important. Oh yeah, I know what it was. So the point here is that, I mean, years ago, before chaos theory was developed, lots of scientists argued that this whole chaos thing is, don't waste your time looking at it. Really, it's that there's these intrinsic, these unavoidable external perturbations to any system. And it's these unavoidable external perturbations which induce this kind of convergence to an equilibrium. And the chaos picture shows that, in fact, that's an unnecessary assumption. It's an unnecessary hypothesis. We see that really it's the intrinsic dynamics which can create this kind of equilibration phenomena. Now, it's true that perturbations will be enhanced by the chaos, but they're not necessary. So now let's look at the quantum picture. So for quantum systems, the situation is far less clear. But in fact, there's been kind of a very rapid growth of interest in this topic over the past 10 years. And I'll mention some of that work in a moment. But what's really interesting to me at a conceptual level, aside from the practical issues about equilibration, is that notice that there is the ideas of Boltzmann and Gibbs, to see how they translate into the quantum picture, were immediately challenged with some interpretational issues, namely this ontic versus epistemic interpretation of the quantum state. So how does that work out? Well, if we think of pure quantum states as some kind of ontic properties analogous to a classical trajectory, then when we look at, say, Boltzmann's point of view, we're gonna have to consider time averages of that ontic pure state trajectory. Similarly, if we're looking at the Gibbs picture, if we take an ontic point of view about the quantum state, so here the ontic view is just that quantum states represent what's real, as opposed to the epistemic view, which is that quantum states represent our limited knowledge or restricted knowledge about what's actual or what the beables are. So in the Gibbs point of view, if we take an ontic assumption or ontic interpretation, then we should be looking at mixtures of quantum states to reproduce some kind of microcanonical or other types of equilibrium. And in fact, this is a common textbook approach. Just say, forget about pure quantum states. Let's just assume we have mixed quantum states and understand how that gives us the properties we want to see. But on an epistemic point of view, which is one that I espouse, one should see phenomena analogous to Gibbs's mixing condition directly in the dynamics of pure quantum states. So then the challenge is to show how this story works. And that's basically what I'm going to try and convince you of today, that this is the right story. So when I talk about complex quantum systems, that's a very jargonistic, very vague terminology. So let me be more precise about what I mean by complex quantum systems. So I basically have two paradigms in mind. So the first paradigm is a many-body system in the thermodynamic limit. So N, the number of systems, is large. And then, of course, what we know then is that if each system has some Hilbert space, DS-dimensional Hilbert space, then the full Hilbert space for the composite system is this N-fold tensor product of the Hilbert spaces of each constituent system, each subsystem. And normally what one does is one is interested in some energy band. So you know something about the energy. Maybe you don't have perfect knowledge of the energy, so you allow some band of width delta E, and we're interested in the subspace of the Hilbert space that's induced by this restriction of energy. So generally speaking here, D is much greater than 1. The dimension of the Hilbert space is essentially huge, even though delta E can be very small. So you look this up in textbooks, and people talk about D being of order 10 to the 10 to the 10. So just some astronomically large number. The other paradigm I'm interested in is few-body quantum chaotic systems in the macroscopic limit. So here the idea is, instead of having n being large, n is actually small, it's 1 or 2, and the limit we look at is this macroscopic limit where the action scale is large of the system. And so when people say things like h-bar going to 0, they really mean that the ratio of h-bar to the action is going to 0. So the action's getting big. And when I say quantum chaotic, what this translates to is this very kind of wordy expression, which is a quantum system whose classical counterpart is chaotic. So take the Hamiltonian of your quantum system, interpret the operators as dynamical variables, look at the classical physics of that system. Is it chaotic or not? If yes, then we call the system quantum chaotic. And again, our Hilbert space is the same thing. It's this d-dimensional Hilbert space, and d is very large. Yes?
That you want to produce everything from the pure state? Like, how does the argument go through from the epistemic assumption to not having to consider this?
The idea is, classically, the Gibbs picture of how we understand equilibration is that let's look at the situation where we have some imperfect knowledge about the ontic situation, about the actual beables, which are, in that case, the classical phase space variables. So, and his idea is, as long as you have some imperfect knowledge, I can talk about the ensemble of possibilities consistent with that knowledge. And then I can show that this has very interesting properties that allow me, that buys me equilibrium.
Because in the earlier picture you showed that if there's uncertainty, right, that knowledge there, it will spread. And as long as you have some region, not zero.
So what I'm arguing is, in the epistemic point of view, you have uncertainty about some underlying ontology in quantum theory, beyond quantum theory. And so the idea is that we have the conditions we need for Gibbs' situation already, even without adding additional mixing. Just the purity of the quantum state corresponds to uncertainty about physical properties. Oh yeah, please feel free to interrupt me with questions. First of all, it makes me feel like you guys actually care what I'm talking about, so don't hesitate at all to jump in. Okay, so the dynamical problem we're going to look at is we start out in this pure state, which is just some projector onto the Hilbert space. We're going to evolve unitarily, so closed system dynamics under some Hamiltonian. And then here's the key point. We're going to kind of make the problem as hard as possible for us. So we're going to consider observables that are maximally fine-grained. What that means is our observable A is going to consist of a sum over rank 1 projectors. So this is kind of the best measurement you can make in quantum mechanics.
So what I want to show is that we get equilibration with respect to these optimal measurements, which I'll call maximal measurements. I know, Lucien, is there some term for this that you use in your work, these maximally distinguishing kind of PVMs?
Yeah, just maximal measurements.
Okay, good. So I'm using kind of what's, okay. So that's what I'm interested in, what we're interested in, I should say. And so here at the end of the day, these eigenvalues are just some labels and they don't really matter. And that happens almost all the time in kind of quantum information theory. You don't really care about these labels. Basically, the quantity we're going to look at then is the probability of some outcome k, given input state psi 0, unitary evolution here. And using the standard Born rule, this is just the trace of the measurement against the time-evolved state. Okay, so what are types of equilibration? So here, what we're interested in is microcanonical equilibration of an isolated system. So here, the idea is one expects relevant observables, dynamical variables, to equilibrate to their microcanonical values on some physically realistic time scale. The quantum microcanonical state is just the identity state on the Hilbert space of interest. There are some subtleties here where if you have more constants of the motion than the energy, then this, you have to fix this picture, but let's just deal with the simplest scenario, which is this case. Now, contrast that with thermal equilibration of a subsystem, where here the idea is one assumes kind of weak coupling to some reservoir which has some temperature, and then you expect the system to equilibrate to the Gibbs state or the canonical state on that subsystem through its interactions with the reservoir. Now, there's been a lot of interest, especially in this thermal equilibration problem. And so I mentioned some, but not all of the references here. This is probably half of the references. Marcus Mueller here at PI has done some interesting work on equilibration. And anyways, this is just a sampling to show you how much interest there's been recently in this topic. But we're going to look at the kind of less well-studied problem, which is this microcanonical equilibration. One, for the conceptual reasons I've already discussed, and secondly, because classically, this is actually the more fundamental problem. But let's first take a look at the classical analog of microcanonical equilibration, just to fix our intuition a bit and understand what we expect in the kind of classical limit. So the classical microcanonical state is the uniform measure on the energy shell, or the accessible phase space. and as I mentioned, this is a more fundamental problem in that one starts from the fundamental statistical postulate and then derives, under the assumptions of weak coupling and so on, the canonical state. So in a sense, if you can show that the fundamental statistical postulate is true classically, then it buys you everything. If you can show it dynamically evolves, then it also buys you the second law, I guess. Now, it's important to realize that there's some constraints here, which is that microcanonical equilibration cannot occur exactly for closed classical systems. So this is the right-hand side of the figure I showed earlier, where this is the spread out lack of knowledge across the accessible phase space, which is this inner box here. And the idea is that the symplectic flow conserves volumes or areas. And so the initial area of that blob was some small fraction of the phase space. And that means the final area, which is the interior of this complex shape, has to be small for all time. And well, it maintains its relative volume with respect to the full phase space. So classically, when one talks about microcanonical equilibration, one assumes a coarse graining of the observable. So it's kind of like a convergence in the weak topology, where one has to restrict the set of observables allowed to some finite resolution. And then what you see is that as the time evolves, and you see this from just standard simple models of chaos, that this becomes increasingly complex and filamentary in its structure, so that in time, the average probability weight in each of these boxes converges to the relative area of that box to the full phase space. What's amazing is that we won't even need to make that assumption quantum mechanically. And that's what's truly remarkable. Okay? So now let's talk about the quantum setting. So similarly, microcanonical equilibration cannot occur. Sorry, it's a mouthful to say each time. Microcanonical equilibration cannot occur exactly for quantum systems, but for a different, or related but different reason. So in the quantum setting, unitary evolution preserves purity. So one can never reach a mixed state from a pure state, and similarly, one can never reach the maximally mixed state from any other state under unitary evolution. So right there, you think, okay, well, you know, don't even work on this problem. But it turns out that there's some ways around this which are quite enlightening. So first of all, we're going to consider equilibration with respect to some observables. So this is this maximal observable A I defined earlier. We want to know how the measurement statistics with respect to that maximal observable converge to what you would expect for the microcanonical state for that observable. Now, what's neat here is that in the quantum mechanical setting, if we have finite dimensional quantum systems, then all observables have kind of an intrinsic discretization, which is analogous to a kind of an intrinsic coarse graining. And this is really nice because we avoid a lot of the problems of kind of infinitely fine quantum interference structures, which one could always say measure by an infinitely fine continuous measurement. Here we have a finite dimensional system, so there is kind of the difference between two discrete eigenvalues is the maximal resolution we can ever hope to achieve according to the laws of quantum mechanics. Yeah?
I missed something. Your initial state and the Hamiltonian that you wrote, do we have support only on this CD?
Yeah.
Okay. So that's the full Hilbert space.
Yes, all my operators are acting on CD.
Okay. That's so the full Hilbert space.
I mean, you could call it a restriction in a sense, but it's defining the system we're looking at.
I mean, the initial state has support there.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, the point is, the initial state could have support elsewhere, but here we're conditioning on the portion of the state that's in this system of interest. Kind of like a filter.
A pure state with support.
I mean, maybe what I said is overcomplicating it. Let's just take the pure state to be.
Okay.
And in fact, this restriction to a microcanonical shell, we don't even have to do that. I just do that because that's what people normally consider.
Sorry. So I didn't quite understand why you say you introduce the maximal variable, and that's supposed to help with the problem that it doesn't exactly occur, as opposed to what?
Well, think about this scenario. If you allow continuous variables in quantum mechanics, and you look at, say, a superposition, a coherent superposition of a Schrodinger cat state of two macroscopically distinct, and you say, it's coherent. Well, the idea is that you get these really fine-grained interference fringes. So in principle, there's always some measurement which you could do that's extremely fine-grained, which would tell you that there's that coherence. And you'd be able to tell that it's not a mixture. But here, if we imagine we have finite dimensional systems, which I think is very common, certainly at PI, if not everywhere in the world, then you don't have to worry about that, because there's going to be some fundamental limit. And let's just talk about that fundamental limit.
Do you do it with respect to all maximal observables, or just...
So for now, the argument is with respect to a certain one. And then if you ask that question at the end, I can talk about how we can generalize this to a tomographically complete set, or essentially a random choice of observable. So let me give you a little more mathematical detail on what the problem is. So we're going to work in the eigenbasis of the observable. So we're going to diagonalize the unitary. So that means that C, and now this is something you have to remember, because C comes up all the time. So C is the matrix that diagonalizes are unitary in the basis of the observable. So under this decomposition, we have that the matrix F is a diagonal matrix which contains only the phases, and C is this diagonalization transformation. Now, for kind of simplicity of the calculation, we assume that the initial state is some projector, eigenstate of the observable. So in a sense, this is also kind of a worst-case scenario. So my initial non-equilibrium state is maximally localized with respect to the observable I'm watching. And I want to understand the time scale on which the state spreads out across that observable, and I want to understand if the probabilities induced across the projectors of that observable become, they're going to have fluctuations, and the question is, how big are those fluctuations? Are they small? Are they big? Can I measure them? Can I not measure them? I mean, can I see that they're there under reasonable constraints or not? So when we do this decomposition, we have a slightly more complex expression, which is exactly what we had before. We've just introduced these C matrices. And so we're starting from this localized state, and we want to see that the probabilities approach the microcanonical values. And whether they do, we want to ask, do they approach these microcanonical values on some timescale that's essentially finite and physically realistic? And do they remain effectively indistinguishable from this microcanonical value for almost all t thereafter? So I'd like to think that we're kind of setting up a hard problem here. And I don't know what your intuitions are about whether this is going to happen or not. Obviously, I would be standing up here giving this talk if it wasn't going to happen. But I'll try and convince you that you should believe the result. And then when we talk about equilibrates, which I'll be throwing that word around a lot, what basically that means in a very precise sense now is that if this property holds for some Hamiltonian and some finite time, then we say that H equilibrates with respect to that observable. So now what I'm going to do is the next three slides are going to be a bit wordy, so we'll have to negotiate whether you're listening to me or reading, but I'm going to give you an outline of the main results and what I'm going to conclude so that as I go through the talk, you can like challenge which steps you want to challenge knowing where I'm heading. So the first thing we're going to do is show that for almost all Hamiltonians H, the probabilities averaged over Hamiltonians, well, first we show that the average over all Hamiltonians is essentially 1 over D, which is the microcanonical value, and that the fluctuations, V is the variance of this probability at each time and for each K, is order 1 over D squared. This means that these fluctuations are very, very small. And then the idea is that the variance and the expectation are evaluated with respect to the full set of mathematically allowed Hamiltonians. And here we're using essentially a random matrix model for defining the measure on the set of all Hamiltonians. And that's going to be this so-called GUE, and I'll describe that in detail. But for now, let's not get into those specific details, but just say that's what we're going to do. Now, you might say, hey, well, if you're taking an average over the ensemble, then you're not telling me something about individual systems, so you're cheating. But the point is, we're not cheating, because the idea is that this implies a concentration of measure phenomena, which means that because the variance is so small, it means that any individual Hamiltonian chosen at random from this set with respect to the measure what we're going to define will be essentially indistinguishable from the uniform measure, which is the 1 over D, the microcanonical case. So that's how the argument works. So this shows that the equilibration phenomenon I want is generic, but it only shows that it's generic in a mathematical sense. So here, you know, we're physicists, we're concerned about physical systems. Physical systems are not random matrices, and they're certainly not drawn at random from any ensemble. They're actually, you build them in the lab, and they have physical interactions, and the strengths of the parameters in the Hamiltonian are defined by laws of physics, which are, you know, not random.
So how does that relate to the prevalence of classically quartic systems among all classical systems?
Well, I don't know if there's a well-defined way to define a measure on classical Hamiltonians like we can do for quantum ones. But from my experience in classical chaos, people tend to say that chaos is generic. But in what sense one makes that precise, I don't know. So there may be some analogy there, but I'm not sure how to make it precise. So the first thing I want to do is show you that results that one gets from these RMT models, these random matrix theory models, are believable because they've been successful for a wide variety of phenomena. So I'll review some of that for you. And I'm also going to provide numerical evidence that the results we need to make this, to make our claim hold, holds also for kind of simpler models. In the first case, we're going to look at, instead of random Hamiltonians from the set of all Hamiltonians, we're just going to look at random Hamiltonians which are restricted to two-body interactions. So it's called two-local Hamiltonians by the computing scientists. So I don't want to mislead you. These aren't physically local. We haven't chosen some geometry and just allowed nearest neighbor interactions. We're allowing all possible couplings. So it's still not physically, 100% physically realistic, but it's closer. And we show that, in fact, we also have numerical results for physically two-local systems, but there's such a wide spectrum of different geometries you can choose, it's just overwhelming. So the ones we have looked at, essentially we see the same results as the two-local case. And so we show that these show the same concentration. So a randomly drawn two-local Hamiltonian will lead to results 1 and 2. These are results 1 and 2. And then also I'll look at an individual dynamical model that equilibrates, which is classically chaotic, and demonstrate that it too satisfies conditions 1 and 2. So I'm going to try and build up the physical relevance of this mathematical model through these examples later in the talk. So I guess you should care because I'm going to reach some really dramatic conclusions, and so you want to find the flaw in my argument if you can, and maybe that'll keep you paying close attention. I hope you won't. So what we find from the random matrix analysis is that essentially we can identify more precisely what the conditions are that a system has to satisfy to equilibrate. And it depends, there's an important dependence on the properties of the eigenvectors of the system. So this is actually an insight that dates all the way back to Asher-Perez in the 80s, and here we make this idea more precise. And we also have kind of a heuristic argument for what kind of condition of sufficient complexity an individual system has to satisfy, based essentially on the same thing here, some kind of eigenvector property, so I'll discuss that. And then finally, at the end, I will discuss the dramatic implications of these results. So the first is going to be to debunk the myth that the emergence of classicality requires decoherence. The second is I'm going to argue for the absence of a proper Newtonian limit for quantum mechanics. And I'll use this famous example of Hyperion to make that point. And finally, I'm going to present arguments for why this implies we should take a statistical interpretation of the pure quantum states. Okay, so if you don't accept any of these conclusions, then you are consider yourself challenged to find the flaw in this argument. All right, let me just stop here and ask if there's any questions about where we're going.
So are the eigenvector stuff, you're talking about eigenvector of the Hamiltonian here?
Yes.
Okay.
Which are also eigenvectors of the unitary. Right. Is that it?
But can you show that all those that quantum equilibrate would classically correspond to chaotic systems and vice versa? Is this really one to one?
I don't know that answer. Good question, though. I suspect probably not. But yeah, there was some subtleties there. But yeah, that's an interesting point for discussion. So okay, so more precisely what we're going to do is, okay, I'm kind of spending too much time on these first slides, so let me speed up a little bit. So we're going to take H uniformly at random from the so-called Gaussian unitary ensemble, or GUE, which is the unique random matrix ensemble that satisfies invariance of the distribution, the probability distribution over Hamiltonians under unitary conjugation. And we want the joint distribution of the matrix elements to be factorable over elements. And in fact, you can derive these conditions from an assumption of maximal ignorance. So what would be the measure on Hamiltonians you would assign if you wanted to maximize your lack of knowledge about the structure of the Hamiltonian? And that implies this. That kind of very kind of reasonable assumption implies this form for the probability distribution, where here this is a probability distribution with respect to the Lebesgue measure on the matrix elements of the Hamiltonian. And notice here that there's this sigma. So C1 is obviously just a normalization constant. Sigma here is a free parameter in the model. And typically what's done is this free parameter is set by the energy scale of the system. So you want to reproduce kind of the maximum minimum energy.
So you're maximally ignorant with respect to constraint on the energy scale?
No, here the idea is, there is some unspecified energy scale, and that has nothing to do with the argument that goes into. I guess the idea is, assume you know the energy scale, that fixes sigma. You know what, maybe I'm speaking too quickly, because sigma only emerges once you have this Gaussian form.
Okay.
So there's some subtlety there that I'm not familiar with about how to motivate this in that way.
You need some constraint, I guess, to meet that these, the thing that you get isn't just.
I think you have the dimension is the constraint, the Hilbert space dimension. Do any of my co-authors have a better answer? Anyway, let me just move on, and maybe we can take that up later. It's not a very crucial point. So just wanted you to know that when you diagonalize these Hamiltonians, you introduce a set of diagonalization matrices C, and that set is distributed according to the Haar measure on the unitary group. So let me tell you the story about RMT and how great it is and how successful it is and how you should believe that it captures relevant physics. So originally this was proposed by Wigner as a model of the level structure of heavy nuclei, which are too complex to describe exactly. So we just said, why don't we look at some random matrix model and see if we can understand something about the nuclear level structure. It was spectacularly successful in doing so. And since then, it's been extended in hundreds of directions. Just to name a few, one is it describes quantum transport and mesoscopic structures very well. And also in quantum chaos, the random matrix models have been wildly successful, and wildly successful, I guess, for modeling few body quantum systems which show classical chaos. And this dates back to this so-called BGS conjecture, which is that we should think about quantum chaos in terms of the properties of random matrices. And so here's just kind of a token result. This is actually some highly excited Rydberg atom with some external electric field applied as a perturbation. And then what one looks at is the distribution of gaps between adjacent energy levels. And you plot a histogram of the sizes of those gaps. And this dashed line here is the prediction of random matrix theory of the appropriate ensemble. So it's an extremely accurate model. And I didn't even pick out like the best example. This is just one of thousands. Just to point out, this other curve here is the Poissonian distribution that you expect if the system is integrable. It has an integrable spectrum. So for GUE, the eigenvectors of this ensemble are an orthogonal set of random quantum states. So the fact that C is Haar distributed means that it consists of a matrix of random vectors. And for chaotic systems, there's been a limited amount of evidence that the eigenstates of these quantum chaotic systems also reproduce the eigenvector statistics of random matrices. So here, Karol Rzeczkowski, who is a frequent visitor to Waterloo, has studied this, and I also studied it, and I think it's in Fritzhof Hacke's textbook as well. And also, there's some work in quantum information where you can look at how this the complexity of the eigenvectors of GUE kind of can be generated by fairly short circuits of random interactions. And so that shows you that you can kind of easily reach this complexity kind of in the lab with the kind of quantum control we have today. Anyways, that's kind of neither here nor there, but it's interesting to note. And I just to show you kind of a limitation of the random matrix models is that if you look at the long-range energy level structure of complex systems, you find that random matrix theory does not reproduce the long-range structure. There, something about the physics of the system comes into play. I mean, large energy scale fluctuations are not modeled by random matrix theory.
So the tail of the distribution is
yeah. And what's really interesting, of course, is that when you look at the zeros of the Riemann zeta function, which are known to follow random matrix theory, they deviate from random matrix theory in the same way that physical models deviate from random matrix theory, namely on the large scale fluctuations in the zeros as opposed to the small scale fluctuations. So this has led people to look for an interesting connection between number theory and chaotic quantum systems, but I think that so far hasn't led to a conclusive answer or insight. Okay, let me move a little bit more quickly. So an important phenomenon is concentration of measure, and that's basically what gives us a small variance, and this is actually a very common phenomenon when you look at physical properties of random systems. Here I'm giving an example just from an old paper. So the idea is that look at this curve right here. This is, you take random states, and here the scale goes from like, this is 0.9 to 1, where it can go all the way down to 1. And so what you see is that the distribution of entanglement of random states is narrowly concentrated about this mean. And in fact, what has been proven is that the width of this distribution goes as 1 over the dimension, and the distance from the maximum goes as 1 over the dimension, which means that almost all random states are almost completely entangled. So this is, again, a concentration. So if I pick a state at random, it's going to have the properties that are typical of the mean. That's the important point. So now finally, I can present our main kind of mathematical theorem about the random matrix ensemble, which is that there exists some finite time such that for all t beyond that time, the mean invariance over the Gaussian unitary ensemble satisfy these properties. Namely, the mean probabilities are essentially 1 over d, and the variance in these probabilities are essentially 2 over d squared. Well, I should say 1 over d, sorry. The delta ik is if you happen to be looking in the outcome bin that's associated with where your initial state was concentrated, there's a very small memory effect, so you get a factor of 2 instead of 1 in your probabilities, which is essentially negligible when d is enormous. So remarkably, what this shows is that for this mathematical ensemble, pure state fluctuations become vanishingly small in the macroscopic limit, or in the large D limit. And then you can use arguments like Chebyshev inequality to argue that, well, for an individual U now drawn from the ensemble, the probability that that individual U has observable probabilities that deviate by, say, some constant amount from 1 over D is less than order 1 over D squared. So this gives you a sense of the rareness of recurrences and large fluctuations. They're suppressed as 1 over the dimension squared, where the dimension is 10 to the 10 or something like that. So for these kinds of fluctuations, sorry for the typo, we have some good arguments for why we expect at least you need order d to the 1/4 trials to distinguish whether or not the probability distribution you're measuring is from a microcanonical state or from a dynamical pure state. So think about this. So I fix my time, I do my maximum measurement, I start getting outcomes in the different bins, and I can keep track of those outcomes. Now what's going to happen? You have d different outcomes where d is enormous. So if you have a small number of outcomes, it's almost guaranteed that they're going to be, each one's going to be a distinct bin for the pure state, which is exactly what you expect for the mixed state. So how many outcomes do you need before you get a collision, say, where you have more than one outcome in the same bin? Well, you're going to have to wait a really long time for that to happen. You have to sample your system a huge number of times to get that. And that kind of argument buys you this scaling. This isn't a rigorous result, but it's just kind of compelling evidence that you need this large number of samples. So now here's kind of the interesting result of this, which is we have this kind of information theoretic constraint on distinguishing pure states from mixed states. based on sampling. So the idea is without any coarse graining of the measurements, and without assuming that we have mixed states from decoherence or whatever, our pure quantum states are indistinguishable from the completely mixed state. And so what we've assumed to get that result is, first of all, there's this limit on how many samples you have. And second of all, we also have to assume that you can't classically compute the details of the dynamical state. So if I could actually, you know, solve this problem of this matrix that's of dimension 10 to the 10, and I could predict which bins have a slightly higher probability, say 2 over d instead of 1 over d, then I could divide all my bins up based on which ones have a slightly higher probability and which ones have a slightly lower probability. And then with just a few samples, I could tell if it was a pure state or the completely mixed state. But the idea is that this isn't realistic. I mean, we're talking about macroscopic systems, so I can't model them quantum mechanically exactly. And the other thing you have to assume to get this kind of result is that you can't perform entangling measurements on multiple copies of the system. So if I have some large condensed matter system, I'm not going to do some kind of jointly entangling measurement on this huge number of degrees of freedom for both systems simultaneously. So the idea is that these are very realistic constraints on what resources you have access to, and that under these constraints, basically pure complex, the evolved dynamical states, pure dynamical states for complex systems are indistinguishable from maximally mixed states. That's the take-home message.
And you don't think that the AB maximal operator is considered by a coarse graining?
Well, there's nothing. It's the best you can do quantum mechanically.
So that's not fine.
So it's not any. I mean, yeah, it's the maximally fine-grained measurement you can do. I'm running out of time, so let me just skip kind of, you know, bragging about how this improves on previous results and move on to kind of talking about the time scale. So you can use the GUE spectrum to estimate the time scale of equilibration, and you get this result, where remember sigma is this free parameter set by the energy scale, and that's going to depend on the details of your system. Masson's and these guys, Visnayak and Zenerik, also use GUE models in the context of subsystem equilibration, and you get similar time scales as we do. But at the end of the day, I wouldn't worry about this too much because, as I mentioned earlier, we know that these random matrix models do not represent large-scale fluctuations of energy well. I mean, the largest distance fluctuations in the energy spectrum. And that's what's going to control the short-time behavior of the system. And so basically, RMT is not going to give us good information about the short-time behavior. So the results I've given you earlier about kind of the asymptotic behavior in time. This is just kind of an interesting insight I wanted to mention really quickly, which is that by averaging only over the eigenvectors of the GUE model, so we don't make, you know, the assumptions about the spectrum that RMT imposes on us, which we shouldn't believe anyways. The RMT spectrum is not a good model on large scales. You can get this nice result which connects the dynamics of the average probabilities to the form factor of the spectrum. So this form factor is just the trace of the unitary. So what's interesting about this, and I think this is kind of a possible direction for future work, is that if you have some either mathematical method or a model or some way to measure, for example, using DQC1, the spectral form factor, then you can infer something about the equilibration timescale if the system is complex and has complex eigenvectors. So I think that's an interesting connection, and a similar result shows up in Brandao's work on subsystem equilibration. So let me just show you a bit about, you know, the Haar random eigenvectors is a very strong assumption. So a sufficient condition, we want to find the minimal sufficient conditions, and what we find is that the minimal condition on the eigenvectors is that they form a unitary four design, well, the matrix of eigenvectors. But more precisely, you need each individual eigenvector, which Cij are the matrix elements of the eigenvector. So here, J refers to the eigenvector, and I is the component of the eigenvector in the basis of A. What you actually want is the fluctuations of these kind of two-point correlators of the components to have the right statistics. And that's it. You don't need more complex, the higher kind of degrees of randomness that Haar measure buys you. You only need this kind of limited degree of randomness for the results 1 and 2, which I showed earlier, to follow. I'm just going to skip this and tell you about some of the numerical results. So basically what we want to do is weaken the assumptions of the random matrix model and just look at two local Hamiltonians, random two local Hamiltonians. So here these are just qubits, and we have single site interactions and two body interactions, and we construct the matrix the coefficients randomly from Gaussians, and we also will look at the timescale of equilibration for this system. So I'm going a little bit fast now, but what this shows is that if you look at the mean and variance of these two-point correlation functions, or these two-two products of eigenvector components, then you find the squares and the circles are the data from the numerical model, and the black line and the green line are the predictions of RMT, of the Gaussian unitary model, so the full random model. And you see that even when you restrict yourself to two-body interactions, you still get the same scaling of these fluctuations. And that's what all you need, remember, to get these equilibration results. And then you can also directly look at the equilibration of the probability of some outcome for this observable, in this case, the observable is the computational basis. And here you see that each system for each increasing number of qubits, the probability starts out at zero, of course, and then it grows to some saturation value. That saturation value is the random matrix value, the RMT value. And we kind of estimate the time scale of this to go as like square root of n. So this is not something that comes analytically out of the RMT model or this two-local model, but rather numerically, we infer it. Yeah?
Have you tried the distribution of the coefficients in the previous two-body random Hamiltonian?
This is the two-body random Hamiltonian.
Yeah. But you're distributing the coefficients between 0 and 1, correct?
Right.
Have you tried between -1 and 1?
They're Gaussian with mean 0 and variance 1. So most of them are going between -1 and 1.
Ah, okay. So it's also
some of them will also be much bigger and much smaller.
Okay. So this is an interesting result because you don't get usually glassy behavior. I mean, it's kind of still fast equilibration.
Yeah. Well, and maybe we can talk about that afterwards.
Yeah, okay.
I'm glad you find that interesting. Okay, I'm just going to skip this slide so I can talk about some of the... Basically, there's a kind of a heuristic argument for what kind of conditions you need on an individual system as opposed to a random matrix model. And this slide is telling you that there's a condition, which is that instead of talking about the average of the matrix elements over the ensemble, if we look at the averages of the matrix elements over the set of matrix elements of that one system, then as long as the distribution of those elements is the same as the Haar random case, then you get this kind of equilibration phenomenon. So finally, let me show you an individual dynamical model. So here we looked at this kind of quantum kick-top model. This is actually a variant of the kick-top, which is has no time reversal symmetry. And so it's faithful to the kind of Haar random case, which is the easiest case to analyze. Well, not actually easier, it's just the one that's just trying to stick to one story here. So you can take this unitary operator for some angular momentum system with these kind of sequential interactions, and then look at the sequence of models where you increase the IREP of the angular momentum, and so D is 2J plus 1, and you look at increasing IREPs of this few-body system. This is essentially a one-body system, and we're looking at increasing dimensions of that system, which approaches some classical limit. And we choose some choice of parameters for tau and alpha so that it's chaotic in the classical limit. And then what you do is you evolve an initial pure state under this unitary, and you look at the probability of outcomes in the z basis, given some initial input state, which is an eigenstate of z. And what you find is that the state spreads on a time scale for this system. The equilibration time is about 4 kicks, 5 kicks, something like that. And so for 2 kicks, which is before you reach equilibration, you see that the fluctuations are getting smaller. But for 10 kicks, which is after equilibration, so the system equilibrates, the fluctuations predicted by the pure state decrease as per the random matrix predictions. Basically, the fluctuations decrease as 1 over d squared. So the point is, again, we have a situation where you won't be able to tell that the state is pure unless you have access to absurd resources. So what's known from quantum chaos is that, generally speaking, quantum systems who have classical counterparts tend to equilibrate on this so-called Ehrenfest timescale, which is 1 over the Lyapunov exponent times the log of the dimension. So this obviously increases very slowly with dimension. And And the kind of the new contribution from our results is to show that once it equilibrates, the fluctuations are essentially negligibly small or vanishingly small as the dimension gets large. So there was another numerical model in 2001 that I studied, and it showed this result. And you know, I talked about this in my postdoc interview and talked about how this was really important and had all these dramatic implications. But in the end, it was just one numerical model. So now here I have like a whole now a theory of which this model is just one example. And so the RMT analysis presents the idea that the properties of these numerical models are generic, that this is the generic phenomena we expect for complex quantum systems. Oops, that should be a quotation, not an 11. Now here's where we get to the interesting stuff, the really interesting stuff, which is that what this tells you is that when you look at the pure state dynamics of some few body system, the classical predictions that you get that this converges to are not the Newtonian dynamics. What it converges to is the Liouville dynamics corresponding to states where you have incomplete knowledge. So what this tells you is that if you want to look to the classical limit of quantum mechanics to see how you should interpret your quantum states, well, the theory that comes out of quantum mechanics under these kind of more challenging conditions than the traditional ones people look at in textbooks is not that the states are highly localized on physical properties. The states are highly delocalized, just like quantum state, classical states with finite support become highly delocalized in the sense of the figures I showed you earlier with this squibbly, you know, the volume preserving but kind of complex spreading of the phase space area. So one can make this kind of argument more compelling in the case of an actual physical system, which is chaotic and we all believe has definite properties, or at least I do. So Hyperion is a satellite of Saturn, which is potato-shaped, and because of the kind of gravitational tidal forces applied to it, actually is chaotic with a positive Lyapunov exponent. So Barry and Sir Barry and Wojciech Zurek have argued that according to quantum chaos, in the case of this Hyperion, an initially localized pure state will spread out over macroscopic dimensions on a timescale of order 20 years. So this is exactly what I've been telling you, right? This is what happens with pure quantum states for complex dynamics. Now for them, this is an embarrassment. This is a problem that has to be solved. For me, this isn't a problem, but for them, it's a big problem because it's an interpretational embarrassment. If you want to think of quantum states as giving you the complete physical picture, then you want to, what should emerge from those pure quantum states is a description of the kind of definite ontic properties of Hyperion. But instead, you don't get that. You get some description of the statistical possibilities that Hyperion could have had in terms of its dynamics. So here, to resolve this, or at least to attempt to resolve it, they just say, decoherence is ubiquitous, so it's going to save the day. It's going to wash out the macro coherence, and so we don't have to confront the fact that, you know, direct observation of Hyperion is somehow problematic because it's coherent. But what I've argued already is that for complex systems, the macro coherence, if we think operationally about quantum mechanics, if we drop our interpretational assumptions and just say, what would I have to do in the lab to measure macro coherence of some object? What kinds of experiments would I have to do? Well, what you find is that you need access to extraordinary resources to confirm that a quantum state is pure. I mean, this is kind of crystal clear in the quantum information setting and maybe kind of lost in this older point of view. But the idea is, unless you have access to extraordinary computational resources or extraordinary experimental control over the system, there's no way you're going to be able to tell that the system is either coherent or mixed. Basically, you can't tell that it's coherent as far as the operational predictions of quantum mechanics go. And anyways, with or without decoherence, if you add decoherence, it's not going to localize the state. The state will now still be delocalized, but just mixed. So the important point is that with or without decoherence, quantum mechanics does not give you the kind of ontological story about what a Hyperion is doing when it's not being observed. And so the point of this is that to get such a story, you would have to supplement quantum states with some additional ontological assumptions. Namely, you'd have to say, well, quantum states are an incomplete description of what's actually going on. And if we want to talk about ontology, we have to look elsewhere, or you know, beyond quantum mechanics. So let me just summarize the results. So for complex quantum systems, pure quantum states generically equilibrate in the same qualitative and quantitative way that Liouville statistical densities do, or Gibbs ensembles do. The sufficient conditions for this equilibration are that the Hamiltonian eigenvector components meet some limited randomness condition, basically a four-design condition, in the basis of the observable. And there's also some condition on the spectrum and the gaps, so they're sufficiently non-degenerate and so on. So these conclusions are motivated by analytically using RMT models and numerically for more physically realistic ensembles and also for models of individual dynamical systems. So an important story here is that you get an emergent classicality under physically realistic constraints without invoking decoherence. So while decoherence is important and certainly does have a role in removing quantum effects, I think it's not the complete story. And if you think of it as the complete story, you miss important insights. And the point is that we get a classical statistical description in the macro limit for individual systems and pure states without adding decoherence and without coarse graining, without limiting the precision of our measurements. And so the conclusion also is that Newtonian theory does not emerge from the quantum description in all cases. Certainly, if you have an integrable system, you can show that a baseball will remain highly localized for the lifetime of the universe. But if you put that baseball under chaotic forces or constraints that lead to chaos in its dynamics, to speak more precisely, then that textbook image, textbook idea fails, and we have scenarios where we can't assume that pure states are localized on the physical properties. So if you want to get a Newtonian description out, you have to find additional beables, whether that's from some decoherent history story or some Bohmian story or whatever it is. We need such a story. And the alternative, which is the sad one, is to simply abandon the belief that the moon of Hyperion is there when no one is looking. So I hope you don't choose that path, because I think we kind of miss a valuable insight if we do that. And the point is, none of these results are surprising. In fact, they're even expected if you started out with a statistical epistemic interpretation. So at the very least, what I want you to take home from this is that, you know, it's good to think about mathematics and physical theories from as many points of view as you can. And by thinking about quantum states from the statistical point of view, even if you don't want to commit to that point of view, it buys you insights into dynamical features of quantum mechanics that you wouldn't otherwise see. So just finally, you know, I kind of would disagree with the Feynman statement here and kind of add some speculative thoughts to stimulate my colleagues in quantum gravity, which is, you know, this kind of notion that when you look at the macroscopic limit of quantum mechanics, you should get a Newtonian theory, I think, is very ingrained. And what I'd like to propose is the possibility that perhaps thinking about this story and these ideas can help clarify the more general kinds of classical limit, the more general kinds of properties one can expect in the kind of macro non-relativistic limit for these, you know, theories of quantum gravity that we're constructing. So, you know, don't throw the theory away if it gives you states that are delocalized, quantum states that are delocalized, because that's entirely classical. and so that's the point there. And then I'll just thank you for your attention.
So are you saying that, for example, in the case of quantum computing, if you want to put together some gates and do some quantum computation, and if it's a lot of gates, and are you saying we have to be careful not only about decoherence, but also it could be that imperfections in the gates, even if there's no decoherence at all, would lead to some Lyapunov exponent and the whole thing would equilibrate and would gain classicality and probably loss of what you need for quantum computing in this way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so this is almost exactly the problem I studied to kind of understand how noise propagates in quantum computers and how one can characterize it. And what's interesting is that whereas classically, when you have perturbations and you have chaos, we know that those perturbations grow in a really bad way, exponentially. You get exponential loss of information. What's interesting quantum mechanically is that you also get essentially an exponential decay of the fidelity as a function of the strength of the perturbations.
But what's interesting about this is that that decay is universal based on the kind of strength of the perturbations. So kind of almost no matter what circuit you're doing, and almost no matter what the nature of the perturbations, just look at the strength of the perturbations, and you can actually predict how fast you will lose fidelity. But what's also interesting about it is that if the circuit is more structured and you don't have essentially a random circuit, then you can actually have even worse loss of fidelity. So for the complex scenario of random circuits, you find that there's a universal behavior, which is exponential. But for more structured circuits, you can either have better or worse loss of fidelity as a function of the perturbations. Essentially, all bets are off.
Could you don't?
So you can have pathological cases, but
could you not just add something to make it more random and then?
Well, this is actually what we do. Ray does this, and David, we basically construct random circuits to characterize the noise, and that's kind of why I know so much about random matrix theory, actually. So there is a connection there.
So I'm trying to understand exactly what you'd say about why it's impossible to distinguish an evolved pure state from a mixed state in a certain scenario. So suppose, let me first talk about the classical case. So suppose rather than coarse graining the final phase space just in terms of a grid, I look at the original localized distribution, right, and it's going to be confined to sort of one grid square relative to some particular factorization. Then I take that coarse graining, that grid work, and I evolve it under the symplectic flow. And now instead of a grid, I've got a partitioning of the space into a bunch of very filamentary regions which cover the whole space.
You're talking classically, of course.
Classically, yeah. And so under that coarse graining, obviously I evolve my localized state to something that's still localized to one of those bins. Mm-hmm. So, you know, relative to that observable on phase space, which is a coarse grained observable, I will see, you know, I won't see a uniform distribution.
Right.
And so you could say the same thing in quantum mechanics. There exists some observable A,
yes,
which is the unitary evolute of the observable,
exactly,
which has the initial state as an eigenstate, which won't look uniformly distributed. And so the question is just, what are you assuming that makes those observables hard to measure?
Well, this is actually very similar to kind of the, you know, what is it, Zermelo or Loschmidt paradox against reversibility, which is that... Okay, let me forget about that analogy. There is a connection there, but let me talk about specifically the point I made. I can't find it, but the point I made about a limitation on your computational resources. So if you have a very large dimensional system, what would be the computation you would have to do to predict what that observable is after some time? And so you'd actually have to evolve that observable under the inverse unitary for whatever that amount of time is, and that's going to be a computationally impossible problem for even modestly small values of d, much less the astronomically large values of d for the kinds of situations I'm talking about, which is many-body systems or macro few-body systems. So the point is, and this ties in with Lucien's question earlier about which observables can you make, I mean, I've just talked about one observable. Well, the properties of the kind of Haar measure, or the GUE ensemble, is that now, the statements I made are true kind of with respect to almost all observables. Yeah. There will be special ones, which you can have great difficulty pre-computing, which would reveal that the state is pure. But I mean, what I'm saying is that those are kind of suppressed, or those are inaccessible in the scenarios I'm talking about.
Even with a quantum computer, it's still difficult to simulate that?
I would guess these results would not hold for dimensions for which you had access to a quantum computer. So if you have a 100 quantum bit computer, then you would have to, this would only be true for systems which have a bigger Hilbert space dimension than that.
So it's a little bit like you're saying that because of the very high dimension, then you're forced to coarse grain. It's not like there is no coarse graining.
Not even forced to coarse grain.
If you could do tomography, you could distinguish it.
Well, here's the thing. So think about this. Now let's take this observable.
So you cannot
take
do tomography because it's too hard.
We'll
so you're forced to coarse grain.
I don't know what you mean by forced to coarse grain. What I'm saying rather is allow me access to a measurement which is maximally fine-grained. How long will it take me to accumulate statistics with respect to that measurement in order to distinguish if the state was pure or mixed? And what I'm saying is the amount of statistics you would have to collect would basically grow as some polynomial in the dimension. Actually, we argue that it's the
the cube root, the fourth root of the dimension.
Okay.
But it's large. I mean, if D is large, then the amount of repetitions, and it would be a controlled repetition. So take Hyperion. I'd have to prepare Hyperion in its initial configuration, and then evolve it for some time, and then measure with this maximally fine-grained measurement. And I wouldn't know if it was pure or not. I'd have to re-prepare Hyperion and measure it again. And I'd have to do that 10 to the 20 times, and then it might have some hope of telling you whether, in fact, it is decohered or not.
No, I agree.
Okay.
There's a question about that. You, the example you gave at the end was the kick at the top.
Yeah.
So is that really an isolated system? I mean, you have a time-dependent Hamiltonian.
Oh, I see what you mean. Yeah. So it's a it's an external force for which there's no back reaction. So it still induces a unitary dynamics. In fact, take that kick top, which is a product of unitaries. I can always rewrite it as some e to the I, some effective Hamiltonian times. I can construct an autonomous, in other words, given any u, so the kick top's unitary, which is constructed from this product of three pieces, and this is in fact induced by a time-dependent Hamiltonian in practice.
Mm-hmm.
You can always think of this as just some other unitary, some effective Hamiltonian. So I can always think of it as a physical system with some effective Hamiltonian that is autonomous in time.
Which is completely time independent.
Which is time independent. So it's equivalent.
I wanted to ask a little more, if you can say a little more about your claim that you do not need decoherence to get classical behavior. I agree. I don't also think that decoherence is the essence of classicality. On the other hand, when you do have classical behavior, typically it goes along with decoherence.
Yes.
So can you say, be a little more precise about in what sense you're not seeing decoherence here and you are seeing classical behavior?
I guess, tell me if I'm capturing the spirit of your question here, but I remember at the beginning of the talk I mentioned how, you know, in the 19th century, people were saying, oh, well, what are the conditions we need to get equilibration? And there was one camp that said, we need external perturbations to generate this kind of equilibration. Other people said, no, well, let's look at intrinsic properties of dynamics like chaos. Now, you could argue that, well, even if the intrinsic dynamics is sufficient to generate the equilibration we want, there are nonetheless going to be external perturbations. So they're kind of ubiquitous, but essentially irrelevant. So that's how I think about it for this scenario. Now there are other paradigms where decoherence is of course crucial to understanding why we're not seeing truly quantum behavior. But I think it's important to understand that depending on the situation, you have a different explanation. And do you know about Zeilinger's buckyball experiments?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean that's a really illustrative example of how essentially they did double slit experiments with buckyballs. And you would think that decoherence would kill your ability to see a coherent superposition of this very large object, like a C60 fullerene. And in fact, they were very hot, like 1,000 degrees, and they would still see the interference fringes. And they had to heat them up artificially, something like 4,000 degrees Kelvin, before the thermal wavelength was short enough to resolve the distinct paths. And so it just kind of, for me, that was very compelling about how decoherence isn't necessarily capturing the full story about. I mean, there the challenge for seeing the interference of the buckyballs was actually having a fine-grained enough measurement to resolve the interference pattern for such a massive object. So the hard part was the measurement precision and not the problem of isolating the system from decoherence.
No, I think I understand. When you say there's no decoherence, you mean there's no environmental decoherence. Was that the point?
Yeah, so okay. What I mean
but
by
there's,
decoherence
there's also
is,
kind of in this sort of decoherent histories approach,
okay.
Which is, again, not the one I completely agree with,
right.
But in that you talk about sort of internal decoherence within
right.
The context of a closed system.
I was talking
you're
about
not excluding that kind of decoherence.
No, I'm talking about external decoherence, which is what people normally talk about in this kind of emergence of classicality, except for in the decoherent histories picture. And one of the things I'm actually curious about is in this kind of extreme scenario of Hyperion or some macroscopic chaotic object, what I'd like to know is, does decoherence give a compelling story for the ontology you expect under that very kind of extreme scenario?
Yeah.
Well, maybe this is a good time to ask my question. Can you back up just one slide? maybe it's one more. Maybe I'm going the wrong direction. I just wanted you to elaborate a little bit more about this coming up with some coherent story for Hyperion, requiring additional vehicles. I don't wonder if you could elaborate. What exactly do you see as the problem here? I mean, sort of get the point about the predictions of the state looking like a classical statistical distribution. So in what sense would those additional vehicles give you a more coherent story, and what would that story be?
Well, if the coherent story is an ontological story. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I believe that quantum mechanics as an operational theory, you know, limited only to its operational interpretation, that, you know, use the Born rule and don't fuss about what's real and what's not real, that can explain everything we see. But the idea is, if we want to say that, you know, by Occam's razor, the simplest explanation of our observations of the macro world, our shared experience, is that there are actually definite properties out there that we're observing, then if you believe that, which I think is a very natural thing to believe, then you need extra beables. You need, because, I mean, one point of view is that, yes, we have that because quantum states remain localized on classical objects. So we have some kind of, you know, the textbook story.
I'm just trying to figure out the distinction between, say, a classical view where things have definite trajectories, but because of chaos, you can't access that information. And I guess I'm still a little fuzzy on the extent to which this doesn't look somewhat similar in quantum mechanics, where you have this pure state, but you can't figure out what it is.
Well, I think it's exactly analogous in the sense that if I'm happy to describe my classical chaotic system by some, you know, initial density, which describes my incomplete knowledge, and I think about that density evolving in time and growing exponentially, kind of my lack of precision with respect to, I mean, so the point is, the initial density
involves... Yeah, I'm just trying to figure out what this tells you, that quantum state can't still be a vehicle.
Well,
you just can't determine that it is that.
I'm not sure why it tells you the quantum state can't be a viable.
Yeah.
Well, because if it was a viable, it would tell you that Hyperion is delocalized over. The point is this: Hyperion. If you assume Hyperion has definite values, then point me to something in the quantum state that tells me what that value is. All the quantum state's going to do is give me the same information that this Liouville density does, which is the set of possibilities.
Unless you make very precise measurements that you argue are very difficult to make.
Well, if I make a measurement, then I get an outcome, and then I update my information. So certainly what you can say is you can use what people have shown, for example, maybe this will help clarify the situation. People like Salman Habib and Kurt Jacobs have looked at quantum chaotic systems, and they've used continuous measurement models, so say continuous weak measurement or something, to show that under such sequential measurements, you get a trajectory, a set of outcomes of those measurements, which correspond essentially to some, like watching some classical chaotic trajectory. So this is part of the operational story of quantum mechanics, can account for our observations, but here I'm going kind of beyond physics and looking to, you know, I want to make a unnecessary assumption that there is some ontology, and want to ask, what do I have to do to find that ontology from the formalism? And the point is that it's inadequate unless you supplement it with viables in some way.
Okay, we have to stop there. So before we find Joe, let me just remind you that there should be some post-colloquium treats downstairs. Let's thank Joe Wilson.